homelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, no, no.
What's up? Welcome to Pod Damn America. I'm Jake Flores. That's Anders Lee.
Anders Lee here.
Is there somebody else here?
There is, yes.
There might be.
I feel like we're not alone.
He's just hacked into our mainframe and is now actually an AI-generated third co-host. We shelled out some extra money for one of those.
We co-host in bio.
Bonus points if your AI is located in the global south, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Jules, hello.
Yes, Jules Taylor joining us from No Easy Answers podcast, who I'm excited to announce we are launching a new podcast today called The Vanquished, which is going to be about failed presidential candidates. And on our Podem America feed after this episode, we're going to put out the first episode of The Vanquished, which is about Walter Mondale. We went all out on this thing. It's basically an audio documentary about Walter Mondale that I've been doing over the course of a year now and have avoided talking about on the show until it's finished. But yeah, excited to get into that today. And Jules, thanks for coming on Pod Damn America.
Yeah, man, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation, both to your project and to Pod Damn America. I'm a fan of the pod. I really like your intro music. And, you know, it's like when I think of, at times when I've been asked to do the podcast music for other pods, like the Valley Labor Report, or when I did the stuff for Max and Working People, you know, Pod Damn America and the theme music you guys have is like just something that I feel like you guys and maybe the guys who cover Alex Jones' Knowledge Fight, y'all have just impeccable intro music. So like kudos and compliments on all that stuff, man, because I look forward to, like, I don't skip it. I look forward to listening to that when I tune in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was old Jake.
As a mashup I made. I stole it from Donkey Kong Country and from the Reverend Wright. The Vanquished, excellent name. You guys sound like a Dark Souls boss. I really like that.
Oh, good.
The Vanquished.
The Vanquished to me, like, it has imagery of like smoke and darkness and like just like kind of a grimness that, you know, Anders, when he approached me about this and said the name initially, I was like, okay, I can get down with that. Just like half an hour into thinking about what it means to be vanquished, I'm like, there's a lot of room here for like sort of dark and sordid subject matter of a grim fate to be met in a similar, you know, narrative and storyline for all these characters we investigate. So I'm personally very excited to see where this podcast leads us.
Yeah, it's going to be a mixture of tragedy. A lot of that in the first episode. Political tragedy. And also comedy, because these guys, there's many of them are clowns. It's funny when people run for office and fail. Biden is maybe the first example of somebody failing up to the presidency in ways we'll get into. But, you know, it's a wide array of people, and we're going to cover it in a wide array of forms. We're going to have comedians, intellectuals, guests, and just using this as an excuse, really, to kind of investigate history through, you know, we are both Marxists, and I kind of like to, and I noticed myself doing this over the course of several years of using failed presidential campaigns as a lens into a historical moment. And it tells you a lot about places and times, even the silly campaigns, and yeah, competing social forces, which ones win out. It's there's a lot there, so excited to tackle that. But before we, I guess, dive into the meat of the episode today, which is about a certain candidate, I'll announce in a second. We're going to cover on today's Pod Damn America. Jake just got into it about our current president, who just did a State of the Union on X.com. What's going on with you and Will Stancil?
I was making fun of Will Stancil last night because I couldn't sleep and I was laying in bed and looking at my phone. I woke up to like a Christmas morning miracle. He's talking to me, which is insane. Why should he talk to me? It doesn't make any sense. He's a crazy person. I know a bartender that like it just texted me one time, like, it's him. He's in the bar with me. And he apparently stayed and like shut down the bar talking to this person.
You so definitely notice him if he comes into a bar, because 10 times out of 10, he is being asked for his ID because he looks like he's 15.
He looks like a child.
Yeah. You're going to have to bring out like, you know, little special lights and verify that that thing is real, because he must, yeah, he must get carted everywhere he goes to buying tobacco even.
Yeah, I wouldn't sell him tobacco. I don't want him smoking with these bad opinions, because smoking makes you cool. I don't know why he's like, why he talks to us. You know, he seems like a true believer in a sense that he really thinks getting online and arguing with all of us is like going to make Joe Biden president or something. But he said the thing about Biden is, yes, he's old, but old doesn't have to be bad politically. Quote, grizzled old guy who muscles through his last reserves of energy to get the job done, end quote, is an enduring heroic archetype for a reason. Glad to see them leaning into it. So this is like him trying to spin the criticism of Biden as being old as like a positive thing. And I thought this probably contradicts everything he said about Bernie a few years ago, because I just, particularly this issue of age, it has always stuck out to me as a thing that like they were just completely 180'd on when Biden became the nominee back in 2020, because it was like the argument against Bernie for a long time. It was like, we need new blood and all this stuff, and like, he's so old. And then when another old white guy got it, it just made it very obvious, you know. It laid it pretty bare, like the bullshit nature of it and everything. So I Twitter searched like the words Bernie and old or something. And what I found is two tweets, one where he said, and this is from 2019, it says, I like Bernie, but when a very old person with health problems runs for high office, it's not usually because they have, in true messianic fashion, taken the weight of the world on their back, all but dying for our sins. It's because they want to be in high office. And I like quote tweeted him with that. And then he responded to me and he was like, this doesn't contradict anything I said, which is crazy. Cause like technically no, but it means that you're like openly like kind of lying about, you know, the idea of Biden being good or old being good. He's just saying it's good, like PR or whatever, good messaging, even though he thinks it's bad, technically, because the other one I found is him saying, and this is from March of 2020, it's quite evident that Biden is acting differently than he has in the past. He's also nearly 80 years old. Worrying about what's happening does not make you a Bernie Sanders partisan. It only makes you sane and honest. And it's in like a thread where he was like talking about how Biden like has dementia. But the important thing is that all this shit was from when he worked on the fucking Elizabeth Warren campaign. So Biden was his political enemy, right? Mm. So he was willing to, you know, to criticize Biden's age and possible dementia addled brain when he was working for Elizabeth Warren, but he's just like switched sides now and is doing this thing where he's like, actually it's like really cool that he's old. It's actually good. People are going to like it. Cause it's like, he's like Danny Glover or something, you know, coming out for one last job. And he responded to me, which means things are not going well in his life at all. And I'm sorry, Will, if you're hearing this, please.
He's running for office right now. He's running for the Minnesota House of Representatives from Minneapolis. He still finds time to get in fights with Jake Flores on Twitter.
Oh, no, he's not going to win. What the fuck are you doing, dude? It's his bio says proud member of Do Something Twitter. this is something, I suppose.
I feel like I oftentimes question, what good does it do to point out moral inconsistencies with someone that has no moral fiber to begin with? And I feel like perhaps the person we're talking about, which I know nothing about, I'm hearing the words Will Stansel for the first time in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm jealous.
But, you know, but I would think that it's not far off of an assessment of this guy. Yeah, I mean, I just, I don't know, man. I think about, you know, I don't know where Will is on the political spectrum, but I know that, like, it pointing out inconsistencies in vantage points of people on the far right doesn't ever really prove effective. It's almost like their hypocrisy is just kind of built in, and you just, like, pointing it out is just kind of like, yes, that's, of course it's inconsistent. That's who I am. That aligns with my inconsistent beliefs, you know? So anyway, just some thoughts around that. But yeah, I don't know why this guy's responding to you on Twitter, dude. That's like,
someone who is ostensibly involved in politics at a serious level. And it's funny how addicted to Twitter he is. And like, he shouldn't care what I think of him or whatever, but he's extremely online. I know people always say that thing. That's like a bailiwick from like 2016 online discourse, is like, no one cares when you point out they're a hypocrite, but like,
right.
I don't know if I think that like some, I think it's not that it's something you shouldn't do. It's just that it's like step one. It's not the whole thing.
Right.
I still have to argue with people.
You know, if he has a large following and if that is pointed out, then maybe they start to question his veracity.
How about this? It's funny. That's enough of a reason to do it.
That's totally enough reason. Yeah.
Makes him look like a dumbass.
It's going to be interesting. I think there's another shoe that's going to drop with him and the Yimby Nimby debate, because from just what I can tell, he seems like very much on the yes in my backyard camp on the housing issue, which, you know, there's a lot of nuance to it, but basically there is a movement of people who frame themselves as progressives often, who are okay with like pretty what is often mass deregulation of housing that, you know, was really good for the real estate industry and not necessarily for renters. And I can see that being an issue in his like campaign, and that'll be funny when that spills over onto Twitter. Yeah, I mean, this past week with the Biden age stuff, that's come up a lot. I watched the State of the Union. I just happened to be home, put it on, and it was kind of amazing to see the cognitive dissonance between, speaking of cognitive, Biden's cognition and everybody on Twitter saying, oh, he's nailing it. You think this guy's too old now? Watch him speak. And he was like stepping on it. He had a lot of clever lines in his speech, but he was stepping on all of them. Like, he wasn't delivering them very well. And also there's a point, this is, I think, was kind of the biggest issue after the fact, but he called a guy an illegal, actually a couple people an illegal, because of Marjorie right. Taylor Greene was like heckling him over a woman that was killed by an undocumented immigrant. I don't know the particulars of that case or how accurate it is or whatever, but and he said, yeah, and he picked up the pin that MTG brought. She brought these pins with this woman's name who was murdered, and Biden picked one of them up and was like, yeah, she was killed by an illegal. And that's why we should have passed my border bill. And that really, I think, is a case in point of this stuff, because either he didn't mean to say illegal. That's not in his heart. He didn't mean to say that, which would then mean he's cognitively impaired and is just, you know, not to say you have to be in Biden's state to say the wrong thing, but it's not exactly an example of him being sharp as a tack, or he actually meant to say it and is just courting Republican votes by adopting Republican policies and now rhetoric that endangers people's lives.
He's also just fucking old. And so like, old people are out of touch. And sometimes you know, you bring like your black friend over to meet your old ass grand parent or something, and they're like, that was the nicest young colored fella I ever met. And you go, whoa, you know, you can't say it like that anymore. Even though they're trying to spin it in a positive light, you know, I think that like, but what that means, that is an indictment of where that person is coming from, though. He's an old man who thinks maybe he thinks it's normal to call undocumented people fucking illegals.
Well, yeah, but he's been in politics long enough, like over the past 20 years, that like that has changed. When you're a Democrat, you're not supposed, and even Nancy Pelosi was interviewed on CNN after the State of the Union. She's like, well, he should have said undocumented. We say undocumented. And she meant we Democrats say undocumented. So there has been a period where it has shifted to that, and he just kind of forgot and went back to like the 90s, which is
the same thing he's doing with his care. It's like where he's truly coming from. I do appreciate the shout out from him, though. That's cool. But the phrase "an illegal" is specifically like a certain type of person says that, and they mean it in a certain way. It's got a real zing to it that is dehumanizing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, there's also this kind of flew under my radar when it happened this past week, but during Super Tuesday, we're watching the pretty unexciting primaries, except for Minnesota, where Uncommitted did pretty well and was I think an embarrassment to the Biden campaign. But there is a guy in North Carolina who just got the Republican nomination for North Carolina governor, Mark Robinson, who is a black Republican and staunchly does not identify as an African-American. There's a speech where he's like, I've never been to Africa. Nothing about me is African. I'm an American. No hyphens, no ifs, ands, or buts. And he also has said some other choice words about that. He was talking about Candace Owens and said someone had asked her which version of the U.S. is better, one where black people were swinging from cheap trees or where women weren't allowed to vote. And he said, I absolutely want to go back to the America where women couldn't vote.
Oh, man. Wow.
I mean, if you watch the full clip, he's saying that at that time, the progressives were Republicans, and that's how women got the right to vote, is through Republicans. But it's still just like a weird thing to say.
Kind of like when I don't know, man, like, I don't know, like, when I've heard this before, when, like, you know, when somebody says, like, oh, well, you know, white people freed the slaves.
Uh-huh.
And it's like that. Yeah. That's a really weird thing to say, dude. Like, Republicans gave women the right to vote or something. Like, that's what?
That's a weird way to
it's even strange for me to even, like, I feel like we're recording a podcast right now. It feels really strange to have said that out loud.
We're going to isolate that audio.
We're going to isolate it, right? Yeah.
Know that you said that. I mean, honestly, that is kind of, like you said, that like they isolated the part specifically where he's saying that to kind of like spin it a certain way. That is the thing that like I don't like it when we do to our political enemies, because I think it like comes around to bite you in the ass, because then their own fans go, look, they isolated what you're saying. And it's making me think about a couple things right now. Like, one of them is like there's a clip of Trump saying like, yeah, I'd be a dictator or whatever. And if you look into the clip and then read his own fans, it's him, you know, he's funny. He's like doing a little kind of turn of phrase. It's still not great, but he's responding to some question by saying, I'd be a dictator for like the first month and then, you know, back to normal or whatever. And I don't even know what the fuck he's trying to explain by saying that. But it's just a crazy thing he's saying. And if you read the like responses to it on, you know, whatever Truth Social or the fuck he's on, his own fans are like more galvanized by the fact that he gets taken out of context and misquoted. That makes them see him as like a truth teller, because they're like, they have to fucking isolate this clip. And I kind of think that's what AOC was talking about a couple days ago when somebody like chased her down coming out of a movie theater, probably going to see Dune 2, if I had to take a guess, or Poor Things or something. Who knows? No, that's not in theaters anymore. But somebody was asking her about why she wouldn't call, she wouldn't use the word genocide about Gaza. And she had one of those politician moments where she was just like yelling at the person and was like, fucking fuck off, you know? And there's been a lot of debate about whether that is her, like, we should hound all politicians. She said that before. But one of the things she's
clear, I just want to clarify, that was not me in the video. That was your boyfriend. A lot of people been adding me about that.
Easy mistake to make. She has a type, you know. who amongst us doesn't? Gingers, baby. But she's one of the things she said was like, you're gonna take this out of context, which I think, you know, that kind of works for the story of who AOC is. Like, I don't want to be too forgiving to this person because they are a politician, and there's like, if you stop criticizing these people, then what's the fucking point? And I know a lot of our fans are gonna be like, you say no, vote blue no matter who, because you aren't saying this one specific criticism of AOC in this specific way or whatever. Like, I hate all politicians, you know. I'm not a fucking Democratic Party shill, but that specific thing that she was saying is like, you're gonna take this out of context, probably true. And I think that's like why she looked so frustrated. So I don't know, I was a little bailiwick of mine. I just think it's like, it's not really that prudent to do these like gotcha clips.
Well, and perhaps that clip is, I mean, to be fair, he does have some other more controversial stuff where, for instance, there's a Facebook post from about 10 years ago now where he's saying, history, who said it, number one. So this is one of those things where it's like, guess who said this quote? The quote is, pride in one's own race, and that does not imply contempt for other races, is also a normal and healthy sentiment. I have never regarded the Chinese or the Japanese as being inferior to ourselves. They have the right to be proud of their past, just as we have the right to be proud of the civilization to which we belong. Who do you guys think said that?
Oh, someone. It can't be good. Pete Buttigieg? No, I don't know who. Is it Hitler?
Adolf Hitler, yeah.
Yeah. I was the number one guess, I think, hanging in the air there.
Right. I was what's the point of that of that guessing game? I guess it's like Hitler had some good ideas. I don't know what else he'd be suggesting there. but he justifies himself. He's like, whether you're talking about Hitler, Chairman Mao, Stalin, whether you're talking about Pol Pot, Castro, whether you're talking about a dozen other despots all around the globe, it's time for us to get back and start reading some of those quotes.
So it's like, just like a reading rainbow.
Yeah. Just people should know quotes, I guess, is what he's saying. There should be a class that's just quotes, where you memorize quotes.
You know how there used to be those programs where you could like read a book and then get a free Pizza Hut pizza? Mm-hmm. Like, he's saying, like, you could do that with Mein Kampf. You know, just read whatever. It's good for your literacy.
I did that program, actually. And now, it's a lot to expect a kid to read an entire book, even a children's book. So I think a quote is more of a 21st century answer to that.
It's like sitting in a therapist's office and you look up into the motivational poster with that quote on it or something, you know. It's like this stuff you find in a dentist's office and, you know. Like, I don't know. I think it's even more startling if you put that quote, like, I don't know, on a front of like a picture of like Mr. Rogers or something. Mm.
Something, yeah, like a rainbow.
You know, like, the rainbow thing going on.
Yeah. So this guy is probably favored to be the next governor of North Carolina. I know it's, you know, I guess for state races, there's probably a little closer than the presidential level. But meanwhile, we have Joseph Robinette Biden, who is right now, and it could be wrong, but the polls are not looking good. Usually at this point, they're pretty predictive as to what happens in November. So judging by historical trends, it looks like he's not going to be reelected. So I wanted to take a chance today and in lieu of The Vanquished, do a little retrospective on one of Joe Biden's failed presidential campaigns, which we could be in the midst of his third failed one. We have a rule on the show. I'm going to try to not do people who were the president, because that shouldn't count. But Biden has lost so many times that it's kind of hard not to. And I thought, it would be a fun entree into the series.
Listen, Jack.
The 2008 primaries. Let's talk about them.
You miss every shot you don't take, Jack.
This is one of the funnier campaigns. I feel like it's kind of been overlooked. We remember 1988, or that came up during his last campaign. And it really is amazing how many dents are in this man's Teflon. And despite all of them, he became president.
Yeah. Remember when he wanted to outlaw raving? That was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And even missteps like in his campaigns, like in 1987, 88, he had a quote. Speaking of quotes, this is an important quote to know, I guess. Neil Kinnock who was the British labor leader, had this speech he would give about why am I the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations of Kinnocks to go to university? And, he had this line about his ancestors working in the mines and then coming up and playing football on top of the ground. And Biden heard this speech and was really inspired by it. He was just like watching VHS tapes of different speeches in the 80s. And
there's mole people out there. They're good, hardworking Americans.
Well, that's basically what he said. And so he would say throughout his campaign for president in 1988, he would say, to paraphrase Neil Kinnock, and he would give the quote and that speech, he would give it the proper attribution. But then at a debate, he just forgot. He just, or for whatever reason, I tend to think he was really feeling it and he took it on as his own. And that line about the mines and the football, he's like, whoa, my ancestors worked in mines and they played football too. It's the same word. Holy shit. I have to give this speech and I make it my own. And he forgot to attribute Neil Kinnock and had to drop out of the race. And it was a big scandal. So 20 years later, some time has passed. He's had the Anita Hill hearings, which he completely botched. Apparently, there were way more witnesses, women who had been harassed by Clarence Thomas, who he just didn't bring to the stand for whatever reason. But he was trying to be in the middle of the road, and he wound up, despite voting against Thomas, he was somewhat responsible for his nomination. After that, he's trying to repair his image. And in 2007, 2008, he announces that he's running for president very early on in 2007. And he kicks it off with an interview in Jake's old newspaper that he used to work for, the New York Observer.
My old alma mater.
Yes. And this is going to come full circle. I have a theory that the New York Observer is indirectly responsible for making Joe Biden the current president of the United States.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah. Email Jake.
It's because of my bad reviews of the show Homeland.
But this is from February 2007. Biden sits down with the reporter Jason Horowitz. They go to a diner in Delaware, and he's wearing a red cardigan and a blue shirt and is yelling over the loudspeakers, which are telling people to pick up their sandwiches. It's a very funny scene. And he's also eating a tomato soup. So it's just this old guy yelling about how he should be president over a bowl of tomato soup. He has all of his talking points in a Mead notebook. He comes out swinging in this interview. He says, Hillary Clinton's campaign, her position on Iraq is confusing and a very bad idea. He said, John Edwards doesn't know what he's talking about and is pushing a recipe for Armageddon in the Middle East. And let me put it this way. He says, you don't hear any of them get in this debate until they announced for president. He even goes after his friend and colleague John Kerry by saying Democrats nominated the perfect blow-dried candidates in 2000 and 2004 and they couldn't connect. That's like a dear friend of his, Gary. This is what he says about Clinton. From the part of Hillary's proposal, the part that really baffles me is we're going to teach the Iraqis a lesson. We're not going to equip them. Okay, cap our troops and withdraw from the support from the Iraqis. That's a real good idea. Sarcasm detected there. And this plan she has on Iraq would be nothing but disaster, he says. And then he goes on to just dump on her being unelectable. And this is, he does the Biden thing where he like lowers his voice to a hushed tone. And he says, are they going to turn to Hillary Clinton? Everyone in the world knows her. Her husband has used every single legitimate tool on his behalf to lock people in, shut people down. Legitimate. It's not totally clear what he means by that. I think it's like just that he's a partisan figure. And she can't break out of 30% for a choice for Democrats. Where do you want to be? Do you want to be in a place where 100% of the Democrats know you? They've looked at you for the last 3 years and 4 out of 10 is the max you can get. And so openly just saying Hillary Clinton can't win the presidency. And this is perhaps part of a longstanding beef that they have. But here's the real gem for this interview, which I think will come full circle. He's asked about Obama and he says,
the first sort of mainstream African American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice looking guy. I mean, that's a storybook, man.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that insults you while he's trying to compliment you. Clean. Yikes. Yeah.
So immediately his campaign is left for dead. The press says that this is, he's shot himself in the foot, if not the head, right out of the gate. He has to go on The Daily Show and talk about it with Jon Stewart. And there's a great clip of him trying to explain himself. And he's like, well, I said clean, but what I meant to say was fresh. Because that's what they used to say. People are fresh. You know, in the 70s, fresh was a compliment. And I was trying to say he has fresh ideas. It's what
Outcast, Stankonia, they're from the South. They talk a little different down there. So fresh, so clean, clean. It's a song about taking a bath.
Yeah.
Everyone loves it.
So he immediately is trying to do more damage control. He says that, you know, Barack Obama is probably the most exciting candidate that the parties have had since I've been around, and call Senator Obama. He knew what I meant by it. The idea was very straightforward and simple. This guy is something brand new that nobody has seen before, which is not really true because he's not the first black person to run for president. Certainly not the first, quote, mainstream African-American, whatever that means.
Used to be only indie black guys would run for president.
I mean, it's kind of true. Jesse Jackson, who was, I think, mainstream, but also running a grassroots campaign. You know, people point out that there are others who were black and ran for president, and he ends up having to call Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and then they are not happy with it. Jackson's quoted, I'm not sure what he means, asking to explain what he meant. I don't know whether it was an attempt to diminish what I had done in 88 or to say Barack is all style and no substance. Because if you look back to the 1988 campaign, Jesse Jackson did way better than Joe Biden, who had to drop out because he was plagiarizing.
Oh, yeah.
But then,
see, this kind of speaks to something I talked about 4 years ago on this podcast. He doesn't have dementia. He's been dumb the whole fucking time. Or maybe he's had dementia the whole time. But my theory is that he has lead paint poisoning. I've been over it. Listen to the old episode. But he's like, the stumbling shit is not like recent, which is not good either. That doesn't prove that he's like mentally sound. It's like he's been like this forever.
Yeah, he's a gaffe machine. And that's what came up in this election. There's another video that resurfaced very quickly of Biden talking to an Indian man in Delaware who's interviewing him. And Biden is so enthusiastic about the level of Indians who have moved to Delaware and says,
in Delaware, the largest growth in population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. To fully, I'm not joking. Oh, gigantic.
So according to him, it's not a joke. I don't know.
Crazy addendum.
Yeah, his son was the attorney general of Delaware. Maybe there was like a regulation where you had to do a racist impression every time you got coffee at a Dunkin' Donuts. I think
the guy's named Apu. He comes to live with the Simpsons for an episode. It's heartwarming. He says, "Thank you, come again. I got your huge, you got your new issue of gigantic asses." He's a pillar of the community.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand what he means by that, because like, is he just, he means there's so many Indians that the accent is contagious? Is that what he's trying to say, I guess?
Oh, okay. I could see that maybe being the bit he was trying to go for.
Yeah. But these, you know, these clips make the rounds on cable news and they're discussed, and he has to try and make up for it, keep plugging away. And so he especially tries to be extra nice to Barack Obama, who is a very young hotshot who at first, there's like an old clip of him being kind of terse with Obama on the Senate floor during a hearing. And then after this scandal blows up, they're both on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Biden is chastising John Kerry, who he's just roasted in this interview, and saying, "Just 1 minute, Senator, we'll have everybody else." He's like telling him to wrap it up. And then Obama starts talking, and Obama's like, "Oh, I know I'm running out of time here." And Biden's like, "That's okay. That's okay. You keep going. You're making a very salient point." So he's trying to get in his good graces and charm him. And it's just amazing that he is the president now and was Obama's vice president, because the gas continues, especially and specifically with Barack Obama, which is part of my underlying theory here. There's a debate. I actually remember watching, this does not reflect kindly on my, social standing as a 16-year-old at the time, but I remember watching PBS had a debate hosted by Tavis Smiley in 2007. And the candidates were asked about AIDS in the Black community, which is a touchy subject, but Biden just bowls full speed ahead right into it.
"I spent last summer going through the Black sections of my town, holding rallies in parks, trying to get Black men to understand it's not unmanly to wear a condom. Getting women to understand they can say no. Getting people in the position where testing matters. I got tested for AIDS. I know Barack got tested for AIDS. There's no shame in being tested for AIDS. It's an important thing, because the fact of the matter is, in the community's engaged in denial. They're engaged in denial. No one wants to talk about it in the community. And we do not have enough leaders in the community and outside the community demanding we face the reality, confront the men in the community, as well as the women, letting them know Sir. There are alternatives."
Thank you.
Tavis, I just got to make clear, I got tested with Michelle. When we were in Kenya and Africa, so I want to...
All right.
I don't want any confusion here.
All right.
About what's going on.
And I got tested to save my life, because I had 13 pints of blood with my wife.
And I'm sure Michelle appreciates you clarifying.
In public.
Let me.
They cut to Al Sharpton, who's just like frowning.
Man, that's crazy. That's like a bad, like comics try to do that sometimes, you know, like this guy, you back me up, you know, white comic just points to a Black person in the audience. He knows. And then they sometimes just get shut down. That's so embarrassing. I hate it when politicians make jokes. They need to just fucking stop trying. Stay out of our fucking realm.
Al Sharpton is later quoted as saying, "Make sure to tell Biden, I take a bath every day, sir." Which is funny that like now he's, you know, a commentator who's constantly kissing Biden's ass. But when he was out of favor, they were all ready to rightly dunk on him. I think the most interesting thing about this campaign, in addition to the gaffes, is Biden's proposal for the Iraq war, how to end the Iraq war, because he would say all the Democratic candidates at that point were saying, we got to get out of Iraq. Let's end the war. But when you dig into the specifics of their plans, really only Kucinich, Mike Gravel were serious about doing that, because all the people who are in the Senate, including Biden, including Obama, Hillary Clinton, were all voting to continue funding the war at the time. But Biden had a really weird plan to end the Iraq war, basically to partition Iraq. He had a plan to divide it into Kurds in the north and then split the rest of the country between Sunnis, Shiites, so they'd be ethnic zones, and then the government would be decentralized.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, which, man. I want to live in an ethnic zone so bad.
Yeah. I mean, this was a plan developed by Leslie Gelb, who is kind of like a foreign policy, Council on Foreign Relations ghoul. And they had a plane ride in 2006 together, and they spent the entire flight hammering out this proposal. And Biden said it was just one of his favorite moments in life, is just deciding how to partition Iraq on a plane with another white guy. It wasn't popular in Washington, because it was, you know, among other things, a dumb idea. He was defending, even to that point, the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, up to 2020, he was saying that it was the right vote, but that Bush lied to him and that he didn't actually say he was going to invade Iraq. The vote was just to give him the authority to do that if he wanted, but he didn't think he was actually going to invade and was caught by surprise. This idea kind of comes from Bosnia, which, you know, was happened in the 90s and not a great system either. You know, at the time, Bosnia had been developed into a segregated society, more or less, between Muslims, Croats, and Serbs. You know, the unless you do that, in Biden's view, you're just going to have continuous civil war. So this would decentralize power, and he kind of makes it into like a parallel with the United States and, like, you know, states' rights and things like that. And, you know, the American experiment, so-called. And this would give Iraqis local control over local police, jobs, education, and services. And this is the only way to end the conflict, in his view, and goes on about the United States. These regions, they'll be able to vote if they're a state or not. So it's just like, you know, Iowa, Minnesota, or Delaware, he says. But this was unearthed in The Intercept in 2019, as they point out, the U.S. is not, with the exception of Utah, which is very homogenous and overwhelmingly Mormon, we don't live in an ethnically divided, I mean, there's de facto segregation in the U.S., but it's not like officially written into law that Lutherans have to live over here, Mexicans have to live over there, you know?
It's like the Lower East Side, you know? Right. Like, yeah. Greenpoint, you know, you can get a good pierogi down there, you know why. But it's not the law that all right. Polish people have to move to Greenpoint.
Yeah, that would be weird.
He's kind of describing, I mean, he might as well quoted Hitler right there. That's like a very ethno-statey sort of way of thinking about things.
Right. And it's, you know, it comes from, he thinks of himself as a foreign policy expert and is actually at the time regarded that way in the press, just because he's been around for a long time and has been on, you know, the Foreign Services Committee. So he supposedly gets this stuff, and he does know a lot of world leaders, because, as he's quick to point out, they were MPs when he was like a junior senator. And so now that they're in the highest office of their land, he has that relationship with them, for whatever that's worth, which isn't that much. But he, in 2007, is able to actually pass this plan in a non-binding Senate resolution, co-sponsored by Sam Brownback, also running for president at the time. Was a Republican, and this is, you know, pitched as a bipartisan solution to Iraq. But at the time, there was an expert, Reid Arvisser, is a Norwegian Institute of International Affairs fellow, and watched Brownback give a speech about this plan, and he whips out an Ottoman era map, so like a very outdated map, and claims that the three provinces in Iraq were each dominated by one group. They say that, you know, this is basically already where people live. Kurds live in the north, but in reality, Sunni Arabs, Christians, Turkmen, Yazidis, they all lived in the north as well. And then you had Baghdad. Well, that's the Sunni area. But in fact, Baghdad at the time was so mixed. It contained all of the Shia holy cities, and the city of Baghdad's population was one third Jewish in 1917. So even historically, it's been a wide array of people who lived there. Basra was a Shia state, but in reality, fewer Shiites than Baghdad lived there. And politically, it was dominated by Sunnis. So, you know, like in much of the world, there's a heterogeneous population, and segregation is not the answer. Despite that, they get this symbolic resolution passed, and it really infuriates everybody in Iraq because they're watching this closely, right? The future of their country is kind of being decided in this democratic primary across the ocean in the United States. Unfortunately, you know, it shouldn't be. So they're watching people's plans, and Biden just inspires outrage from Iraqis because it would mean like forcible removal of people from different neighborhoods. You would have to be like, you know, we're talking about population transfers that I guess would be enforced by the U.S. military, right?
Cleansing, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah. And it's like wild. It's just like some senile guy from fucking Delaware possibly causing this to happen to your entire country.
Right.
It's just some white guys sitting around carving up land, creating ethnic zones.
Yeah.
Really?
78% of Iraq was very opposed to this proposal. 13% agreed. You know, there was support and some support among Kurds, but other than that, it was a very bad idea. But it was something that he like kind of clung to even after he was vice president and was like sent to Iraq after the war had like quote unquote ended. He would insist to the people who are like bringing him around, who are experts in the region, people who lived there and were from there. And he would say like, no, I understand Iraq. I get it. It's sectarian. That's all it is, there's, you know, different sects and they've hated each other for thousands of years. And he would always bring it back to being Irish and say, my grandfather was Irish and hated the British. It's like in the Balkans. They all grow up hating each other, is what he says.
That's so fucking dumb.
Yeah. But he refuses to listen to, and thankfully he wasn't in charge at that point, but he's refusing to listen to other experts who point out that ethnicity is a factor, but it's not really like the dividing line. There's secularists and there's Islamists, and a lot of people in Iraq want to move beyond sectarianism, and he just could not wrap his head around that.
He doesn't seem like he really understands why the Irish hate the British, which is like kind of an easy one, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It all comes back to these like primordial sort of ethnic identities, you know, not understanding that history and identity and these things are fluid and they change over time and are, you know, shaped by social forces. But
Biden is like certainly not a materialist, I guess. He's like not sitting around being like, well, material needs on the ground at Ireland at the time where, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, I think about like how does one go about learning about the world and like not make a connection with materialism that leads them to this like weird sort of fucking, this isn't even like a gaffe. This is like, It's like, I'm aware of history. I've just not really considered it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
like it, fuck, man.
Is aware of it and then doesn't understand it. I mean, like, this is like a fucking obvious point, but that's like, that transfers incredibly easily to why he doesn't understand Israel and Palestine, because the way that people make that opaque to the advantage of Israel is to be like, well, they've just both hated each other forever, you know,
yeah.
And like,
yeah.
Not point out that there's some sort of dynamic power imbalance or whatever. It's like they're Hatfields and McCoys or something like that.
Right. You know? Exactly. And that, you know, it's, this is an interesting window into the late aughts, because people had grown disillusioned with the Iraq War. And there's a certain amount of guilt about, you know, the American empire and our standard of living also, you know, with other countries in dire poverty and the, you know, different genocides and conflicts happening around the world, including in Darfur, where for a minute there, that became like the cool war, right, to get involved with. Biden said they need to establish a no-fly zone, and you may need to send U.S. troops, which, like, at the time, that was kind of like the progressive position, is like, we have to invade another place as if there are no other alternatives. And there's a great moment in one of those debates where he's talking about this no-fly zone, and Mike Gravel, who also admonishes Biden for his Iraq plan, is like, how arrogant it is to tell these people how to run their own country. He points out, like, the governments in Africa don't want the U.S. invading. That's not a good solution to this. And that's kind of the only button the U.S. knows how to press, whether it's Somalia or, in retrospect, a lot of the naysayers about Rwanda, sadly. You know, the takeaway from that was that we could have stopped a genocide if we had just, you know, sent more troops and weapons and things. But there's not a lot of historical evidence that actually would have helped. But he goes on, and there's a few other funny debate moments. You know, Kucinich at the time is really one of the two anti-war candidates on these debate stages, and Biden is asked, all the candidates are asked to say something positive and something negative about the candidate to your left, and the candidate to his left happens to be friend of the show, Dennis Kucinich.
I don't like a damn thing about him. I'm only kidding. Only kidding. Dennis and I have been friends for 25 years. I think this is a ridiculous exercise. Dennis, the thing I like best about you is your wife.
And Congressman Kucinich talking about Senator Gravel.
Wait a minute. He talked about my wife.
Well.
Who is? Yikes.
Famously, like, three times the size of Dennis Kucinich. He is at this time known as the gaffe machine. And this is, I think, an example of his wit actually working. Brian Williams asks him at a NBC debate.
Senator Biden, words have in the past gotten you in trouble. Words that were borrowed and words that some found hateful. An editorial in the Los Angeles Times said, in addition to his uncontrolled verbosity, Biden is a gaffe machine. Can you reassure your voters in this country that you would have the discipline you would need on the world stage, Senator?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Biden.
Oh, you can't argue with that. I guess that is kind of a funny one.
Yeah.
All right, I'll hand it to him.
It's funny how, like, an example of his wit working is an example where he just omits his wit entirely and just says, yes.
It's kind of a meta joke. All right, yeah, Sleepy
Joe.
It's
been a long time since we've, like, had seen or witnessed Biden's wit working. You know, like, politics is so much like a game of who has the better zinger at times, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like Biden is just kind of ill-equipped at this point going into, like, a I mean, I just can't imagine like the things that Trump is going to say about him, and he's just going to stutter in his responses at this point, or something's going to be sad. You know?
He does a lot of like telling the joke, it not working, there being a weird moment, and then he starts laughing at it, and then like sort of smiles to someone and makes them start laughing, and then everyone's just like, ah, ha, 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 yes, of course. So the emperor's clothes-y sort of situation that happens in joke telling a lot. It sucks.
Yeah. But that, it, in a way, that's kind of the only point of his campaign, is to get in some of these moments on the debate stage, because he's, you know, not taken seriously after that Observer interview. Like, immediately, it's like, what is this guy doing? What a boob. And he never really gets anywhere near even third place in the polls. Which was his goal. And he's very adamant, like, I don't want to be anybody's Secretary of State. I don't want to be anybody's vice president. I'm in this to win it. But it does raise, what was he still doing there? Because, you know, anyone could have told you he wasn't going to win. But some of these debates, he gets in a line about Rudy Giuliani, and he's like, in every Rudy Giuliani sentence, there's a noun, a verb, a 9/11, which is pretty good. But by the time the voting starts, yeah, there's no foreseeable way he's going to win. The Iowa caucus, he gets 1% almost of the vote, and he's, you know, raised like nowhere near any the other candidates' fundraising, because he just doesn't. Number one, he's just not a good fundraiser. Like, he's not, despite being like extremely corrupt, he is not good at that part of politics somehow. Maybe because like he wastes his time in a way, like talking to everybody. Like, he does love walking around and talking to people. And there's still footage of C-SPAN on the C-SPAN archive of him just like making the rounds and like talking to everybody who will listen to him. And he'll just inevitably wind up talking about Delaware and how Delaware is misunderstood. But he has to drop out. There's like a period there where, you know, Obama and Clinton are going at it, and finally he gets the nomination. That did take a long time, you know, relatively, like that primary between the two of them. And yeah, there's speculation, who is Obama going to select? And in the summer of 2008, he picks Biden, and at first Biden doesn't want to do it. But basically, his mom makes him. She's like, you're going to be part of history. The first African-American wants you to be his vice president, and you're going to say no. And that, like, that seals the deal for him. So he says yes. I have a theory here, and it's not, I think it is a pretty credible theory. Like, other people have said this who are more in the know. That comment that he made about the first clean African-American, right? That is, I think, the reason Biden became Obama's VP. Because at the time, you know, it was a very big deal to have a black president of the United States. Like, that just on a cognitive level was an explosive thing that people at that time did not think was possible, right? So that's, you have to warm your way up to most of America, which at the time and still today is Caucasian. And so how do you do that? Well, you pick a white guy, but not just any white guy, a white guy who has said racist stuff specifically about you. That's the way you ingratiate yourself into the eyes of white America.
Okay, I see.
Because we've all said dumb stuff. If you're white and American, I'm sure we've all said something stupid and embarrassing, and that we like to hear when the person on the other end of it is cool with it and is like, "Oh, yeah, I know what you meant. Not a big deal. You're it's good, man."
Like, disarming in a way.
Yeah,
I think you're probably right, because otherwise that would have got politicized and used against him. But he like got in front of it in a certain way, and Obama was really good with like the PR and stuff. I mean, I always, you know, just generally kind of understood Biden to be like, in a sense, a more conservative politician that helped balance out a lot of the fears that people had about Obama being like radical or whatever, mm-hmm. because he was talking about closing Guantanamo and stuff like that. But this is interesting because I don't fucking really remember. I'm older than you guys, I think, or I don't know about you, Jules, but I mean, I remember all this, but I don't really. I remember the election. I don't remember like the fucking soap opera of it and all this stuff Biden said. That's really interesting. Damn, is that what damned us to the fucking hellhole future we live in?
Yeah,
Biden's mom.
Yeah, and him putting his foot in his mouth and failing up into the White House, and fortunately is leading us all towards disaster.
The ethnic zones didn't work out. I know you really had your heart set on carving up Iraq into sectarian zones that would live in harmony together. But, you know, next best thing here, you can be, you know, vice president, dude.
That's crazy that he didn't want to be vice president.
Yeah.
It seems like a good gig.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's has kind of a chip on his shoulder, kind of an ego. And like he said several times over the course of his campaign that he was the most qualified person to be president and didn't want to be in somebody's back seat. And so it should be him. I mean, there's probably something to not, you know, saying, yes, I'm running to be vice president, right? That's generally not a good look, but I think he believed it and was high on his own supply. And, you know, he's saying at the time, I'm the only person running in either party, Democrat or Republican, who 3 months ago put out a plan for Pakistan. And, you know, just bragging about his experience with this stuff. And it was true. He was a creature of Washington. He had been around a while. He understood the issues, but only within sort of the contours of like the Washington consensus, and had some antiquated ideas about a lot of things and still does.
Yeah.
So like after Trump gets elected, right, and Biden is no longer VP, you know, Biden claims to have come back because of what he saw going on during the Trump administration. How far, like, out of it do you think he was? Like, was he really out, or was he planning to come back, do you think?
Was Biden planning to come back and run?
Yeah. Biden, you know, like, because he said he saw what was going on during the Trump administration, decided he needed to come back for the sake of the country, right? Mm-hmm. Like, was he really out, do you think, after he was done being vice president, or was he just, like, planning to come back with the next? Does you know, like, part of me feels like if he was really out, then maybe he was perhaps satisfied with his role, you know, as a VP to Barack.
Yeah.
And maybe could have, you know, rode into the sunset and been happy with what he had done.
Right.
And I wonder, just because he's a politician, like, how much truth there is in that, like, oh, I came back because of the country needed it. And it's like, bullshit, man. Maybe you were just always planning to come back because you know, even though you were VP, it wasn't satisfactory, we'll say, you know.
Yeah, I think, and I remember the reporting at the time in 2008, Obama sat him down and was very adamant that, like, bro, this is it. You are not going to become president. Don't think about that twice. Like, you are going to be my vice president. And maybe this was part of, like, Obama getting some comeuppance and being like, he was probably pissed that Biden said that racist shit about him. So he's like, I'm going to make you my vice president, buddy. But once 2016 rolled around, he was definitely thinking about it. I think Obama talked him out of it. And I think one of the key reasons he didn't run is because his son had just died. And while that's a very, like, moving story, it's a little weird to be running for president with your main message being my son is dead, you know? So
put that on a lawn sign.
Yeah. But I think, like everybody else in 2016, he expected Clinton to win. And so, I think at that point he was resigned to, like, yeah, I'm not going to be president. But then once she lost, and you can see that video on the day after the 2016 election. Obama gives a speech and he's like, the sun is still up, you know, with the earth is still moving. And Biden is just like hamming it up right behind him. He is like gleeful, like the happiest I have ever seen him because.
Oh, man, that's weird. There was a glint in his eye.
Yeah.
He's already planning.
And here we are, stuck with the geezer.
Well, you know, I think Trump and Biden are always kind of in a competition in my own mind for who was the funniest, like funnier president, you know, like, and just in that category, because like Trump says some outrageous shit and does tremendous damage, obviously, in it. But like, you know, I mean, obviously so does Biden, but like there are occasions where they're like the absurdity of what we're witnessing creeps in and provides a well-needed comic relief, you know? And, and so like, for me, it was kind of always like a toss up, but then like you move on to like, all right, well, first round's kind of evenly matched, right? Maybe we go on to the children. And then like Trump always had more like destructive than funny children. And whereas like Hunter Biden is out here, like there's videos of him, you know, getting sucked off in like Asia somewhere in a laptop and shit. And it's like, what is going on with Hunter, man? You know? So at least like there's that aspect of Biden, but the right wing picks up on that shit too. And I don't even know, like, is there really stuff on Hunter's laptop or is it just like more of, you know, this crack smoking fucking home videos, you know? but yeah, it's incredible, man. It's fucking incredible to like to witness the narrative of like Biden as, you know, VP and shit. And then coming back to be president, but all the while, like, there's, I don't know, man, like the story of like, you know, fucking around in Ukraine with Hunter and the same way that like, you know, Trump on the right wing was like, you know, fucking around with Ukraine stuff too. And then the Ukrainian war just breaks out too. I mean, there's just so much there under the hood of all of this that I feel like, you know, part of what The Vanquish does is like unearths this stuff and reminds us of some of the drama and soap opera and shit that went on. And you know, this was an unusual story because at least, you know, this story ends with somewhat of like our character becomes vice president, you know, and that doesn't happen with most of the stories that we cover, obviously. So yeah, I mean, he ended up as vice president, but maybe that wasn't satisfactory for him. Maybe he had to come back and be president I don't know. I just, anyone who enjoys walking around talking to people the way that like with the derives the satisfaction the way that politicians tend to, it's always suspicious in my mind as to what that sort of can delineate of their greater character, you know.
It's
a little bit suspect to me.
You know what I was thinking about the other day that I forgot for some reason, but I think is a really funny blip of a moment. It's right after Biden won and he started calling Pete Buttigieg like, he's like a son to me.
Really?
He's had this weird moment where he kept calling Pete Buttigieg like, and Pete, you know, because after the primary in 2020, when he got it, he was kind of like having this moment of like, no, we're all one big team. Kamala, she's my friend. Even though they had like previously, you know, had like really confrontational words, you know, in the debates and stuff. He's trying to smooth everything over and he kept calling Pete Buttigieg is like my handsome beautiful gay son or something. And what the fuck ever happened to that? I think my prediction for the election is Pete Buttigieg is going to legally change his name to Uncommitted and then try to take all those votes, and I hope he wins.
That's not a bad prediction.
Seems a speed away from the Iowa caucus claiming victory or something, you know.
Yeah.
You should do an episode on him.
Yes, we'll have to at some point. I am trying to save some of the 2020 people for at least a little bit because it's still like we all lived it. We covered it on this podcast. Yeah. But we'll definitely get to him at some point. But yeah, up first we got Mondale and then we got some other guys, Goldwater, coming down the pike.
Right.
So subscribe to The Vanquish on wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our Patreon where we're going to have our bonus episodes and bonus content, full interviews from this first full-on audio doc we did about Mondale. Not all the episodes are going to be like this, but we went all out on this first one. And I do want to be sure to shout out somebody who I stupidly forgot to mention when we recorded our first episode. And that is that we got this hotshot voiceover artist to record our intro and actually read the selections from Walter Mondale's autobiography that are in this first episode. A guy by the name of Don Lee, who may or may not be my father biologically.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, he's shout out to him. He did a great job on the intro and all his audio work. I highly recommend. But yeah, check us out. And
yo, what's the name of that that really long book that your dad narrated about Vietnam?
Kill Anything That Moves.
Wow. Which,
it's by Nick Terse. It's about war crimes in Vietnam. And
your dad's so cool, man.
Yeah. I listened to a clip. You can find a clip of my dad reading it online and just like a small snippet of, I think, the My Lai massacre.
Nah, dude, the whole thing is on YouTube, man. I found it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Of Don Lee? Oh, wow. Okay.
It was too weird to fall asleep to, man. It was too weird.
Jeez.
It was really long, so I thought I would listen to War Crimes as I...
Did he blank out just now?
Yeah, maybe he'll come back in a sec.
You muted yourself.
Oh, you know what it is, dude? I got a cat, and this cat is very uncourteous towards my podcast recording habits.
Yeah, they're like the...
They love to jump on the desk. So see what this cat does? She falls asleep on the windowsill and then she falls off. You know? And like, it happens 3 or 4 times a day and it's fucking hilarious and it never loses. I just don't even open the window to give her more space so she can just keep falling asleep and falling. And anyway, so she got up and ran across the desk, muted me for a second. Thanks for that, Fifi.
Hazard of the trade.
Well, yeah, what I was saying is that I it was unsuitable. Your father's narration of Kill Anything That Moves was unsuitable for sleep. And so I'd turn it off, but I meant to revisit it later because that's very interesting to me to be able to take in that as an audiobook, especially narrated by your dad. Very cool. Other than that, man, that's all I had about your dad and your pops and stuff. I think it's really cool that he narrated the stuff. I think it was really dumb of you to forget about shouting out your pops.
I know.
It was really like, but we're doing it now. But yeah, and we got interviews with David Parsons coming up too, man, scholar of the Vietnam War. And we also have some stuff going on with ironic professor Rob Larson. On Ross Perot. I mean, Rob, Rob was on No Easy Answers, and we talked about Hayek for a while, and Rob wrote a whole book length rebuttal to The Road to Serfdom.
Nice.
And cool stuff. But anyway, so we got lots of cool stuff happening with The Vanquished, and I'm excited about it.
Hell yeah. Cool. Well, yeah, the first episode will be up in this feed, and then subscribe to our main feed and patreon.com/The Vanquished.
Cool. Love it. And shouts out to Don Lee. Very cool. I'm going to listen to that book. That sounds badass.
Right, everybody's gonna look for the book now and forget about The Vanquished.
Yeah.
No, I'm gonna subscribe to your dad's Patreon. Support him and not you. Okay.
If you're into choral music, then that's the place to go.
I have some plugs. If you're in Los Angeles this Sunday, which I think will be like kind of the day you're probably listening to this, unless you're real head and you'll listen to it when it comes out tonight. I'm doing a set on a fundraiser. It's a solidarity fundraiser, raising funds for our friend's activist legal fees because he got pinched by some stupid DA. We did an episode about it. You heard it. He's a street medic. It's going to be at First Street Pool and Billiard, 1906 First Street, Los Angeles, California, March 10th, 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. I'm doing a little MC work. I'm going to be telling some jokes in between musical acts and stuff like that. So come on out. And other than that, listen to Why You Mad. Listen to that's my podcast. I Don't Know You. Those are my other two podcasts. And subscribe to Andrew's dad's show.
All right. It's finished.